Chapter 1. The Second Pit. Joseph knows his tears. Joseph, too, by the law of correspondence between above and below, was thinking of the flood. The two sets of thought met, or rather, if you like, moved parallel to each other far apart. For this young specimen of the human race, thinking them here on the waves of the Gior, bowed down by the weight of events and the traditional procedure of punishment for guilt, was thinking with much more immediacy and associative energy than were the hosts above, who, having no experience of suffering, were just having a pleasant, refined little gossip. But more of this later. The convict lay discomfortably in the plank compartment which served as cabin and storeroom to a smallish freight boat built of acacia wood with a pitched deck. It was a so-called ox-boat, such as he himself had used taking goods up or down the river when he was Montcalm's pupil. It was manned by four oarsmen, who had to take to their oars when the wind died down, or was contrary, and the swaying double mast was lowered. They stood on the platform of the forward deck. There was a steersman aft, and two under-servants of Petipre acted as escorts, also served at the ropes and with the lead. Finally, there was Kamat, the scribe of the buffet. To him had been entrusted the command of the ship and the transport of the prisoner to Zawi Rey, the island fortress. He carried on his person a sealed letter, which the master had written about his erring steward, to the warden of the prison, a captain of troops and writer to command of the victorious army, named Mai Sakme. The journey was long and protracted. Joseph thought of that other early one, 7 and 3 years before, when for the first time he had voyaged on this river, with the old man who bought him, with Mibsam, his son-in-law, Epher, his nephew, and Kedar and Kedema, his sons. In 9 days they had come from Menphe, city of the swaddled one, to No-Amen, the royal city. But now they were going far beyond Menphe, yes, past On, the Golden, and past Per Bastet, the city of cats. Zawi Rey, the bitter goal, lay deep in the land of Seth and the Red Crown. That is to say, in Lower Egypt, down in the desert, in a branch of the district of Mendes, which there is called Jadet. It was to the abominable goat district they were carrying him. The thought gave his apprehensive and brooding melancholy an added pang. Yet it was not without a sense of destiny, a heightened emotion and lively play of thought. He was a son of Jacob and his real and only wife, and never all his life long would he be able to check this play, just as little now as a man of 27 as when he was a simple, inexperienced lad. And the kind of play dearest to his heart, most fascinating to his mind, was the play of allusion, so that when his life, so painstakingly introspected, seemed full of that quality, and its circumstances to show themselves suffused with correspondences to the motions of higher things, he was prone to feelings of satisfaction, since such correspondence could never really be wholly sad. Sad enough in all conscience his circumstances were, and sadly musing, he pondered them as he lay with his arms bound together at the elbows across his back in his little compartment, on the roof of which the provender of the crew was heaped up. Melons, ears of maize, and loaves of bread. He had returned to a hideously familiar state. Again he lay helpless in bonds, as once he had lain for 3 horrible days in the dark of the moon, in the hole of the well, with worms crawling and rustling about him, and fouled himself like a sheep with his own filth. True, his present state was a little less rigorous than before, because his fetters were not much more than a matter of form and for appearance's sake, being a piece of ship's rope they had forborne to tighten. But even so, his fall was not less deep and breathtaking, the change in his life not less abrupt and incredible. That other time, the spoiled darling and pet of his father, always anointed with the oil of gladness, had been treated in a way he could never have dreamed of. This time, it was Usarsif, he who had mounted so high in the land of the dead, who was head overseer and dwelt in the special chamber of trust, who tasted all the charms and refinements of culture and arrayed himself in pleated royal linen. To this Usarsif was his present treatment now meted out. He was sore smitten indeed. Gone all the fine folded linen, the modish apron and elegant sleeved coat, this being now become the evidence which spoke against him. They had given him a single garment, the slave's hip apron, such as the crew wore. Gone the curled wig, the enameled collar, the armbands and necklace of red and gold. All this refinement and beauty was vanished away, not one poor ornament left, save on his neck the little packet with the amulet which he had worn in the land of his fathers, and with which the 17-year-old lad had gone down to the pit. The rest was laid aside. Joseph used the significant words to himself, an allusive phrase, as the fact itself was an allusion and a matter of mournful order and correspondence. It would have been quite false, traveling whither he traveled, to wear breast and arm adornment. The hour of unveiling, of putting off of ornaments, was at hand, the hour of the descent into hell. A cycle had come round, a small cycle often completed, but also a greater, too, bringing round its like more seldom, for the revolutions of the two coincided with each other at the center. A little year was returning on itself, a sun year, insofar, that is, as the mud-depositing water had run off again, and, not by the calendar, but in practical reality, it was sowing time, the time of ploughing and hoeing, the breaking up of the soil. When Joseph now and then got up from his mat, and Kamat allowed him to walk on the caulked deck, with his hands on his back as though he held them there at will, he would stroll about or sit on a coil of rope in the clear, carrying, echoing air above the water, and watch the peasants on the fertile shore performing their careful life-and-death task of digging and sowing that was hedged about with so many taboos and penalties. A mournful task, for sowing time is mourning time, time when the corn king is buried, when Usir is borne down to the dark, and hope is seen but from afar. It is the time of weeping. Joseph wept a little himself at sight of the corn-burying little peasants, for he too was being buried again into the darkness and into hope only too far away, in token that a great year had come round as well and brought repetition, renewal of life, the journey into the abyss. It was the abyss into which the true sun descends. Etura, the subterrestrial sheepfold, Arala, kingdom of the dead. Through the pit he had come into the land below, the land of the rigor of death. Now again the way went down into boar and prison, towards lower Egypt. Lower it could not go. Days of the dark moon came again, great days which would become years, and during which the underworld had power over the beautiful one. He declined and died. But after 3 days he would rise again. Down into the well of the abyss sank Atar Tammuz as evening star. But as morning star, it was certain he would rise up out of it. This we call hope, and hope is a precious gift. Yet after all, it has something forbidden about it, because it contracts the value of the hallowed present, and anticipates the festal hours of the cycle which are not yet at hand. Each hour has its honor, and he does not live aright who cannot despair. Joseph held this view. His hope, indeed, was the most certain knowledge. Yet, as a child of the moment, he wept. He knew his tears. Gilgamesh had wept them when he had scorned Ishtar's longing, and she had prepared tears for him. He was thoroughly worn out from the sore trial he had endured, the pressure from the woman, the severe crisis of the climax, and the utter downfall and transformation of his life. The first few days he did not ask Kamat's permission to walk on deck amid the color and bustle of Egypt's great artery. He lay alone on the mat in his pen, and wove a web of dreamlike thoughts. He dreamed tablet verses. Ishtar, the raving, bounded to Amo, king of the gods, demanding revenge. Thou shalt create the steer of the heavens. He shall stamp on the world, singe the earth with the fiery breath of his nostrils, wither and destroy the ground. The heavenly steer will I create, Lady Ashirta, for grievously art thou affronted. But chaff years will come, seven in number, years of famine, thanks to this stamping and singeing. Hast thou provided food, heaped up provision, to meet the years of want? Prepared have I for food, heaped up provisions. Then will I create and send the heavenly steer, for sore art thou affronted, Lady Ashirta. What singular conduct! When Ashira burnt to destroy the earth because Gilgamesh shrank from her and demanded from heaven the fire-breathing steer, there had not been much sense in accumulating food for the 7 years' shortage the steer would cause. But anyhow, that was what she had done, accepting the condition because she so burned for the avenging steer. What pleased and intrigued Joseph in the whole thing was just this precaution, which the goddess, even at the height of her fury, had to reckon with if she was to get her fire-breathing steer. Foresight, carefulness, these were familiar and ever-important ideas to the dreamer, however often he might in his folly have done violence to them. And they were almost the first law of life in the land where he had grown up, as by a spring, the land of Egypt. For it was a fearful land, its folk engaged in endless effort, with every kind of magic and charm it could command, to close up all the crannies through which misfortune, great or small, might creep in. And he had now been for so long an Egyptian himself, his fleshly garment made of purely Egyptian stuff, that the national watchword of care and foresight had sunk deep into his soul, where it found its twin already at home. For it was deeply rooted in his native tradition, where the word sin had almost the same sense as want of foresight. It meant folly. It meant clumsy dealing with God. It was something to jeer at, whereas wisdom meant foresight and care for the future. Had not Noah Utnapishtim been called the exceeding wise one, simply because he had seen the flood coming and provided for it by building the great ark? The ark, the great chest, the Aron, wherein creation survived in the time of the flood. To Joseph, the ark was the first instance, the earliest pattern of all wisdom, in other words, of all knowledgeable foresight. And thus, by the root of Ishtar's fury, the trampling and fire-breathing beast, and the heaping up of provisions as a safeguard against want, Joseph's thoughts followed trains parallel to those in the upper sphere about the great flood. Of the little flood, too, he was reminded with tears, the one which had come upon him, because while he had not indeed been so lost in folly as to betray God and cast himself out, yet he had certainly been guilty of woeful lack of foresight. He acknowledged to himself his sin, just as he had done in the first pit a great year before, and his heart was sore for his father Jacob, and bitterly ashamed before his face for having brought himself down again to the pit in the land whither he had been snatched. What a lifting up had come of that snatching, and what a downfall and abasement had followed it, all due to the want of wisdom. The third, that is, the making come after, was so far away now that it was quite out of sight. Joseph's spirit was honestly crushed. Humbly he implored pardon of the spirit of his father, whose image had at the last moment saved him from the very worst. But to Kamat, the scribe of the buffet, and his guard, he was careful to betray no depression, partly out of tedium, partly to enjoy the humiliation of a man who had risen so far above himself. Kamat often sat down by Joseph to talk, but Joseph treated him with hauteur and reserve. Yes, we shall see that after a few days, and simply by his way of knowing how to put things, he induced the guard to remove his bonds and let him move about freely, although Kamat thus ran the risk of sinning against his duty as guard, and ought to have been afraid to do it. "By Pharaoh's life," said Kamat as he sat down in the pen beside Joseph's mat, "how you have come down in the world, ex-steward, and sunk beneath us all, after you had so nimbly mounted above us. One can scarcely believe it. I can only shake my head to see you lying there like a Libyan prisoner, or a man from the wretched Kush, with elbows pinioned behind his back. A man who got up so high and was head over all the house, and now you are, so to speak, delivered over to the devourer, the bitch of Amente. May Atum, Lord of On, have mercy on you. How you have bowed down your head to the dust, to use the jargon of your wretched Syria, which we have picked up from you. And by Khons, we are not likely to pick up anything else, for not even a dog would take a piece of bread from your hand, so low are you fallen. And why, forsooth? Out of sheer frivolity and lack of discipline, you were bent on playing the big man in a house like ours, and could not bridle your reeking lust. And it had to be our sacred lady and mistress on whom you fixed your lewd desires, when, after all, she is almost the same as Hathor's self. That was shameless enough. Never shall I forget how you stood there before the master when he pronounced justice in his house, and hung your head, because you found not the least word of excuse, and knew not how to wash yourself clean of your guilt. How could you, when the torn garment spoke loud against you, which you had left in the mistress's hand when you vainly tried to overpower and assault her, and it was plain you had even gone about the business very clumsily? It could not be worse. Do you remember how you came to me in the pantry to fetch the refreshments for the old pair in the upper story? You were impudent enough even then. I warned you not to spill the drink over the old people's feet, and I felt rather mortified when you behaved as though such a thing could not happen to you. Well, now, you have spilled something on your own feet, so they are all stuck together. No, no, I knew you wouldn't be able to hold the tray steady in the long run. But why couldn't you? Because, after all, you are a barbarian, a sand-rabbit, with no more self-control than the wretched Zehai, ignorant of our standards and knowledge of life here in the land of men. You could not truly lay to heart our precepts, which teach that one may take his pleasures in the world, but not with married women, because that is risky. But you, in blind lust and unreason, leaped at our mistress, and you may thank your stars that you were not put in corpse color at once, and that is the only thing you have to be thankful for.